Good evening and welcome to This Week in Football from the makers of Low Limit Football. I am your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Roberto Rojas, and special guest from the BBC and World Soccer Magazine, Tim Vickery, to break down the great Edson Arantes do Nascimento, otherwise known as Pelé. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me. Tim, I want to start off by asking you about Pelé's beginnings. I mean, we've seen documentaries on it, how he grew up poor. One of the documentaries that I saw, or movies that I saw on his life, one of the memories that I take from that movie was him learning to juggle mangoes versus juggling soft ones versus juggling hard ones, and really taught himself touch. He comes from a mother that didn't want him to play football, but a father who was a professional footballer, and then makes his way to Santos at 15 years old, where he becomes his legendary self. Tell us a little bit more about his coming through, through his childhood, coming up into Santos, and then his debut at the 58 World Cup.
Well, one of the defining moments in his life, I think, is the injury that his father suffered. His father was a very, very promising player, gets a big break, and on that day of the big break, he suffers a big break, suffers a serious injury that ends, really, his pretensions of his dreams of making it in top-class football. And now this, in the mind of Pelé's mother, meant don't do it. Don't do it to the son. You know, don't do it. It's an insecure profession. So firstly, it plunges the family into poverty without the prospect of getting out of it. Secondly, it plants this firm idea in the mind of Pelé's mother, who's a very, very strong character. You know, her son is, none of her sons are going to follow this route. This is a time when Brazil is expanding. And there are opportunities, you know, a steady job, but which is the dream, really, if you come from the precarious poor, you know, the dream of a steady job in the growing bureaucracy. That's very much what she wanted for her son. I think Pelé, in some ways, is a perfect synthesis of the two of them, of the two of his parents. His father was much more easygoing, an easygoing character, and you see that in his easy smile, but with considerable footballing ability. His mother has the strength, real strength of purpose there. And the fact of being thrown into this poverty without an escape route, the fact of the necessity of having to overcome maternal resistance in order to take up a career in professional football, that leads directly, I think, to the almost insane drive and determination that Pelé has to be the best and to be rewarded for being the best. I think you could probably make a comparison these days with Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, that almost insane drive that Cristiano Ronaldo has. And we could probably imagine that in this sad downtime at the moment, you know, some players are lying around or training half-heartedly. You can imagine Cristiano Ronaldo doubling down on his gym work, you know, to make sure that he is going to be even better when he comes back. And Pelé had a lot of that. And a lot of that comes firstly from the strength of character of his mother, but secondly from the realization that this could end at any time. But it's obvious very, very early that we are dealing with an absolute football prodigy. And Pelé was a machine for playing football. It's all there. Right foot, left foot, acceleration, balance, head, vision, physical strength. Every component that you'd want to tick off to be a world-class player is there. But Pelé knows that the talent on its own is not enough. You got to have the drive so he's experimenting as a kid with breathing patterns at the moment when he brings the ball down on his chest. You know, it's an almost insane devotion to duty that he has. The downside of all of this, the downside of this drive, is that I think that Pelé will probably go to his grave not feeling financially secure. I think that's such a demon in his mind, the idea of growing up without financial security. And anyone who's had that experience knows that it lasts for life. You know, even looking at your bank balance doesn't necessarily end that trauma. People who've been through this experience know this. And so some of the perhaps questionable decisions that he's taken in his post-playing lifestyle, some of them have to do, I think, with the fact that he just can't switch it off. He can't switch that drive off. And I think that the roots of that drive were a pride of being the best and a fear of poverty. So he's got that mixture, that pride and the fear both firing together. And that, with the natural talent, makes him perhaps the greatest player ever to have played the game.
And, you know, Tim, we focus, and obviously we'll go into his entire career as a whole when he was a player, but going into the next segment about how him, Pele, the persona is perceived outside of a football pitch, you know, because we understand that when we're dealing with someone like Pele, we're dealing with someone that obviously gave not maybe just Brazil the best PR possible, but probably what the sport has been able to give. I mean, it really was able to globalize, and, you know, this is a time when, you know, he really was the main star and will continue to be the main star. He is always going to be identified for the sport to the day he dies and after that. I mean, he's just been that special, and he's given so much. And we've seen it with the relationships that he's had working for as a politician, as an ambassador, you know, his relationships with numerous politicians and other players as well. I mean, how is Pele the person outside of a football pitch is perceived, maybe not just in Brazil, but I think around the world because of what he gave to the sport?
Well, that ready smile is that captivates, doesn't it? Behind the ready smile, I don't think people really know him particularly well. And here you can draw such an obvious comparison between Pele and Maradona, and Maradona is just utterly spontaneous. If he feels it, he does it, and he says it. You know, and Maradona, in his time as a Boca Juniors supporter, having his own box there at the stadium and taking his shirt off and swirling it round his head as he leads the chants. Can you imagine Pelé doing that? Everything with Pelé is more calculated, which makes him, I think, harder to get to know on any deep level. He's come across. Certainly internationally, it works so well because you don't need much more than that kind of ready smile. It's a great point you're making, I think, about him being a PR game, a PR machine, not only for Brazil, but also for the sport of football, because Pelé is so associated with the World Cup at a time when the World Cup was undoubtedly the main event. You know, when it was much, much more important than club football, it was where you looked to see the best standard of football, new tactical innovations, and you know, Pelé won it three times. But I think there's a real irony there, an unbelievable irony, if you like, because Pelé and the World Cup are so linked. But I honestly don't think the competition ever saw him at his best. The two times when he wins it participating, 58, and he's wonderfully refreshing. Scoring, doing fantastic things, imaginative things, but he's still a kid. He's still a spindly kid. He says it's probably the most important goal of his career, the one against Wales in the quarterfinal of the 58 World Cup, where Wales are putting up blanket defence and Brazil just can't get their way through. And in the end, defining the thing in tight space, Pelé scores the goal that's the only goal of the game. Well, remember, there's no substitutes those days. Up in the commentary position, commentating on Brazilian radio, there's Leonidas da Silva, the biggest star in Brazilian football probably at that point, the top scorer of the 38 World Cup. And Leonidas is saying, before the goal, Pelé's got to leave the team. He's got to be dropped. So imagine if that goal hadn't gone in. Imagine, you know, either Brazil get eliminated or Brazil get a goal from somewhere else and go through, and then Pelé's dropped and suffers a blow to his pride and his momentum. So 58, he's doing wonderful things, but he is still a spindly kid. And 1970 is so special because it's the first one that most of the world saw live. And the TV images from Mexico are just out of this world. They're unbelievable. It just looks so great. And Pelé's at the hub of a brilliant team. And he does wonderful things in that team, both individually and also collectively. But the best Pelé, by then, by 70, he's put on a few pounds. He doesn't quite have that surge with the ball anymore. He's not at his best. He's past his best. He's still great, but he's not quite what he was. And if you look at 62, now 62 is the World Cup where Brazil win it, but he's injured in the second game and he plays no further parts in the tournament. In that first game, Brazil beat Mexico. If you look at the goal, you can see it on YouTube, the goal he scores against Mexico. It is unbelievable. You're watching someone from a different planet. The way he dribbles through he just surges through. You get it all there. Pace, power, acceleration, close control, head still when he's finishing. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary goal. And that era, I think, was the best Pelé, kind of 62, 63. But the World Cup didn't see it because he was injured in that second game. And obviously, the next World Cup, 66, Brazil have a poor team, and he's kicked out of the competition and doesn't really leave much of a mark. So he's this great PR machine for Brazil and for football and for the World Cup, despite the fact that I don't think the World Cup ever saw him quite at his best.
Now, Joe, going back to us, and I think this kind of relates to both of us, because even though Pelé has really identified, is really someone that has identified himself as being the best ever and has demonstrated the beauty of what is the World Cup and the beautiful game as well. I mean, here in the United States, you know, what he was able to achieve in those two short years at the New York Cosmos, even though it did take a while for them to find that consistency back until 1994 when the World Cup happened, mm-hmm. you have to really say that Pelé was kind of the first pioneer to help grow the sport here in the United States, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, in doing my homework in preparation for the show, you know, I watched a couple of different documentaries. I'd already seen the biography on him. And they made it a point that was kind of the focus of bringing him over here to the New York Cosmos when they did that. I think it was in 1974, was the fact that they wanted to kind of raise this new NASL up. And that was the goal of it all. And his final match was against Santos at Giant Stadium, was a sold out crowd. And for soccer, that was unheard of at the time. I think it was 70. I want to say it was 76 or 77, somewhere in there. And you know, it was unheard of, but that was one of the main focuses to bring a guy like him, you know, to bring a guy like Giorgio Chinaglia and some of these other players was to build this fledgling league into something that was a little bit more on the world stage. And unfortunately, it did die down once the stars left. But that was the main purpose here was that, you know, Pelé adding his name, his star power. He transcended football. We see it with many other athletes across various genres, and he was certainly the first one that really did that, and that was kind of the focus for him, and he did raise NASL and soccer awareness to a point before it had its collapse. Tim, I want to jump back to you now because I want to talk about Pelé's position, because as his career went on, he's played a couple of different roles, mainly a centralized role, but he's played as the number nine, the main striker. He's played as a reserve striker. And if I think, Tim, and I want to go back to your comments on the 62 World Cup goal against Mexico, I think in that particular in that match, for me, when I watched those highlights, was that he was more of a second striker. He also ended up becoming a deeper playmaker later on in his career when his legs couldn't handle quite the rigors of playing in the number nine or the number 10 position. For you, where was his best position on the pitch?
Off the main striker, mm-hmm. off the center forward. So he's got liberty. He's got the freedom to drop. To advance and to surge, because that surge is unbelievable. He's also from that the centre. If he can drop a little bit, he's got the panorama in front of him. He can play long either wing. So I think that was the place where you got most out of him. Not right up there, and he was very lucky, I think, in that through so much of his career, he had great partners. I once had the real privilege to go in depth about Pelé with Tosh Dahl. Now, Tosh Dahl was the centre forward in the 1970 side. He wasn't really a centre forward. He never played centre forward before Tosh Dahl. It was an improvisation that Brazil made. But part of the thinking there was when they tried in the build-up to the World Cup, when they tried more kind of traditional target men centre forward, they couldn't play with Pelé. Because in order to play with Pelé, you got to be really good technically and really quick mentally. Because that's a level that Pelé's operating on. You know, on Pelé, obviously, I would hope, and if you haven't, please put this right, you've seen the film Raging Bull, the Martin Scorsese boxing film. And quite often there, you see the things from the point of view of the boxer, Jake LaMotta. You see it happening in slow motion. And the great player sees the game in slow motion. The player who's being outgunned, overwhelmed, everything's happening too fast for him. But the great sees it in slow motion. And Pelé was so just mentally sharp that one of the things he perfected was playing like a 1-2 off the legs of an opposing defender. It's brilliant, but he could see it in his mind. So if you're going to play with him, you got to have the ability to follow his thought and then to combine with him at the speed that he's going to play these passes. So, you know, your big traditional target man didn't really work with him. And when he first got into the Santos side, he had a player there called Pagan, who was a small, technically very, very neat striker. And somebody old school, when I met them, they're no longer around, but would say that he was just an extraordinary player. And then for years and years and years with Santos, he had Coutinho. Coutinho looked very similar to Pelé, and they would exchange moves at such speed that it was very hard to follow. And, you know, with the 70 World Cup, that idea of Tostão was a wonderful improvisation. Tostão, as he himself would say, wasn't really much of a centre forward, didn't really offer much of a threat to the goal, wasn't that quick, but he was on the same wavelength as Pelé. So, you know, the ball will always move quicker than a man. So Tostão's lack of pace, not too much of a problem, because he can read Pelé's mind and he can play the reverse passes that Pelé wants to get the ball and give the ball. And Tostão would tell me how imposing Pelé was with a look. You know, he just looks at you and you know what he wants. So he was lucky with the partners that he had, which I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, I think we're going back 15 years, he did a list of great players, and he didn't include anyone that he played. His original list included no one that he played with, apart from his old, it was a list of living players. A lot of them are no longer with us. But the only teammate he included was his mate from New York Cosmos, Carlos Alberto, you know, the right back, the captain from the 1970 side. I know Tostão was very angry about this, you know, not because he himself had been excluded, but because so many of the great players that Pelé had played with had been excluded, like Coutinho, who played with him at Santos year after year after year. That was Pelé's vanity coming out, you know, because he was very lucky in that he played with players who were good enough to operate with him and make him look even better as well.
Definitely. And you talk about that great Brazilian Santos side that, you know, won the first few Libertadores and also and we'll talk about this in a bit, that famous win against Benfica in 1962, where he was at his best. But before we get into that, Tim, I mean, was there always going to be that kind of interest? Cause it's kind of the running joke that we probably would make, is that if Pelé had played in 2020, seeing performance that we saw early on in his career in the 50s, he'd probably be shipped off to Europe as a teenager. But I was just doing a bit of research and saying that, you know, after the World Cups that he won in 58 and 62, many numerous clubs around Europe wanted him. Real Madrid, Juventus, Manchester United, Inter Milan. But the government of Brazil, the then president at the time, declared him a national treasure so that it would prevent him from being transferred out of the country. Do you feel that was probably the right decision that he would have made? And perhaps if he had gone to Europe, you know, would his status of being a legend be much bigger than just playing in all his 18 years in Santos?
Perhaps, because there is a problem. And you mentioned Santos winning the Libertadores and wrapping it up with the old Intercontinental Cup in 62 and 63. But after 65, Santos stopped playing the Libertadores. And the reasons for that are obvious. Now, we're in an age before TV, before there's money from TV. So, you know, your money basically comes from the box office. At that time, the Libertadores was, from a financial point of view, suicide. Financial suicide, you know, because still to this day, as I'm sure you know, Rob, travel in South America is precarious. It's expensive, you know, compared to Europe. Getting around South America is very, very expensive. So, and clubs paid a price for playing the Libertadores. They didn't get a fee for playing it. They paid a price for playing it. And as a result, Santos pulled out because it just didn't make any economic sense. And what they did instead was just play friendlies. So they played the São Paulo State Championship. They played forerunners of the Brazilian Championship, but they had lots of time to go all around the world playing friendlies. And it was a real punishing schedule that Pelé had to, you know, because everyone wanted Pelé on the field. So, you know, there's a game every 48 hours or something like that. So, you know, because he stayed in South America, his career outside the national team is an accumulation of friendlies. Had he gone to Europe, you know, with Europe, traveling Europe being easier, the distance being smaller and so on, he would have played in the then European Cup, as the Champions League was known at the time. A European audience would have seen him more. I mean, his career in Europe, there's nothing after the 66 World Cup apart from the odd friendly. So really, his career in Europe ends very, very early. Really ends in the early 60s. So had he come to Europe, he would have played probably fewer games, but more competitive games. As a result of that, I think the European audience would have seen much, much more of him at his peak.
And we definitely, the European audience were able to get to that kind of enjoyment back in 62 in that Intercontinental Cup against Benfica. I mean, Tim, I mean, that's a famous game in itself. Why is it so famous?
Well, that tournament, for a while, it was great. It's one of the big what ifs of football. You know, what might have happened to that competition between the winners of the champions of Europe and South America. And this, again, this has something to do with Santos pulling out, because it left the field open to the Argentines to dominate the Libertadores at a time when Argentine football was at its most nasty. You know, that you'd had the golden age of the 40s and the early 50s. And then when, after their international isolation, they come back into the World Cup in 58 and they're thrashed, they really toughen up and they get nasty. And it led to a real clash of cultures when you get the Northern Europeans starting to win in Europe and Estudiantes and so on winning in South America. And pretty soon that old Intercontinental Cup loses all relevance. Whereas for a while, for the first few years, there are some wonderful games which have kind of been forgotten a little bit in football history. It's like a dead end of football history, which is a shame, because that really was something, and it could have gone on to be something even better. So when Benfica met Santos in 62, it's a huge thing. It's the biggest thing in the club game in the world. And after a narrow defeat in Rio, because Santos, they're just a national institution. So, you know, and Santos itself is a fairly, you know, it's a fairly small city. It's remarkable that this team have such a history. It's like, you know, because Santos is the port of the metropolis of São Paulo. So, you know, Santos having more titles, more Libertadores titles than Corinthians is like Brighton being bigger than Arsenal. It's a remarkable achievement. Some of this happened before Pelé. And one of the great things about the Pelé story is he joined Santos just as they're becoming fantastic. He joined the club just at the right time when he's thrown in at the deep end, but surrounded. I mentioned Pagão. He had Jair Rosa Pinto, one of the best players in the 1950 World Cup, as a veteran to kind of bed him in. So he was very lucky with his teammates right at the start of his career, and that really got him going. So the 62 things, when he's absolutely at his peak, and after a narrow defeat in Rio, Benfica are very confident of overturning that back in Lisbon. And you can see the highlights again on YouTube. And Santos go 5-0 up So it's all over as a contest before Benfica get a couple of late consolation goals. But you just watch him, and again, it's like watching someone from a different species. And he's up again, and it explains why Portugal kicked the hell out of him in the World Cup in 1966. You know, because they knew very well what they could do because he'd done it against the Benfica defence in 66. You know, you get the whole thing, the power, the pace, the vision. The calm in front of goal, the calm to pick the right option. And Pelé rates it as the greatest game of his career. And so it's such a shame that tournament so quickly, so soon afterwards, became a kind of dead alley of football.
You know, it was interesting to watch the documentary on that because that team going into that 66 World Cup was also kind of a little scattered where there was no certainty on that team. And many say that led to them being bowed out a little earlier. Obviously, the way Portugal manhandled Pelé in that match really was also another part of taking Pelé out and then basically taking the soul out of Brazil. And it was an iconic moment, obviously, for the Portuguese. Obviously, the great Eusebio played in that match. But I want to go into the iconic moment now your personal iconic moment for Pelé in his career. And I know there are a million to mention. I know we've talked about the 62 World Cup goal against Mexico, which I went back and watched that. And it was just watching the highlights of that 62 match against Mexico. There were always two defenders on Pelé when he did not have the ball and three when he did. And the ability to go through that. And there were times you could see him probe and probe and probe and really just make that last second pass where he'd already beaten two players. It was something to watch. And then to get that goal with that strength was amazing. But there are many iconic moments. You talk about when he scored his 1,000th goal in the Maracanã against Vasco da Gama. It was a penalty kick, but it was the kind of thing where the team was trying to get him that 1,000th goal in such a cathedral of world football at the Maracanã. You talk about the hat trick in the final against Sweden in 58 when, you know, he's just coming on as a 16 and 17-year-old. New York Cosmos fans will remember the bicycle kicks. It was something that, for me as a child, that's my memory of Pelé, is that bicycle kick that you'd never seen it before almost, and here he is doing that. So Tim, is 62, is that goal against Mexico your moment? Is there something else? Is there maybe a moment we haven't mentioned yet that you'd want to go to?
Well, he's very, very aware that 70 is the defining statement of his career. He's very aware of this. You know, because he had said after 66 he wasn't going to play in any more World Cups, and he spent a couple of years outside of the national team. But then he's made up his mind. I wish, because I was just too young for 70. My first World Cup was 74. It's the one when I kicked every ball, and I wished he'd played that one as well, and he could have played that one. But he wanted to go out on a high, you know. You know, he's always obsessed with his place in the pantheon. His prestige, you know, it's that competitive thing that you don't just switch off. So I wish I'd had the opportunity to see him in 74, because I think he could have done it. But I love some of those collective moments from 70. The little pass to Jairzinho for the goal against England. I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of those Brazilian players from 70. I've never met Pelé, but I've met a lot of them, and they've all said that goal won Brazil the World Cup. It's just a fabulous little pass from Pelé. The pass for, I know the game was done and dusted, but the pass to Carlos Alberto for the fourth goal, you know, in the final, is an extraordinary pass. The dribble around Matakevich, the Uruguayan goalkeeper, in the semi-final. I don't know if you've seen the move. It's an incredible move.
I have.
On earth? How on earth has he done that? How on earth has he thought that? You know, when it looks as if they're going to collide as they come out for the ball, and then Pelé dummies, runs round the other side of the goalkeeper and just hooks it back, and it just goes wide. Yeah. How had he seen, you know, the idea of that, of being visualised in his mind before he did it in a split second? It's an incredible thing, unbelievable thing. So even though I don't think it's anything like Pelé at his best from a physical point of view, from a technical and from a collective point of view, some of the things he did in 70 were unbelievable. And even the goal against Italy, the first goal, it's a game in the first half. You know, I think in the first half, Italy had more shots than Brazil did. And Brazil knew that Italy weren't going to last the pace. But the first goal, you know, he's it looks like a kind of routine header, but it isn't. You know, he's been marked by Bernie, who's an experienced man marker. And Bernie said afterwards, you know, we jumped up at the same time. And like a normal human being, I came back down to earth, and he stayed up there. You know, Bernie said, I went into the game thinking he was a normal human being. I don't think that anymore. Remember, he's doing that under real pressure, because he knows that he's going to be judged. His legacy is going to be judged by what happens in that tournament and in that game. And that's what the great players do. When the pressure's really on, they deliver.
They stepped up. It's true. You know, Rob, I want to ask you about the same thing. I want to ask you about your personal moment for Pelé. And you and I talked about it earlier, in that match against Italy in that final. Probably the greatest thing was actually not the goal that he scored for me. It was the no-look pass to Carlos Alberto that was running down the right side. I mean, Pelé never lifted his head. He just played it out there, and he knew Carlos Alberto was going to run right up there and just one-time that shot, and the rest is history. It was a magical pass, and we talk about, you know, the 1,200-plus goals that Pelé scored in his career. Here's one of the moments that's one of the great moments for him, and it's just a no-look pass. It's gorgeous. You know, what about you, Rob? What would be your moment?
I think when it comes to someone like Pelé, it's kind of like the old phrase, Vini, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. You know, he came in 58, demonstrated to the entire world as a 17-year-old. Now, mind you, you know, we talk about 17-year-olds nowadays just like breaking into academies. I mean, yeah, you can make the comparisons of young players breaking in. I mean, we've seen the likes of, you know, Messi, Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo, being those kind of great players as a young teenager. But Pelé was doing it in a World Cup final, in his first World Cup final, and to get Brazil's first title. I mean, that just shows that he's here to stay. Obviously, 62, where, as Tim said, is probably the best of his career, which in itself is insane to think about, because, you know, a 21, 22-year-old in their prime, which typically they're still, in today's game, they're still looking to become that finished product. And here, Pelé has seen it all and done it all already, and he was the best player when he was already a teenager and a young adult. But as I think all of us have said, I think we have to agree that 70 is probably his most defining moment. You know, he wants to go out as a legend, and you know, he was already a living legend for the last 12 years. He wanted to continue that in the Azteca Stadium, 100,000 people, high altitude, mind you, as well, as we definitely know. You know, the big opening goal for me, I mean, the no-look pass, I mean, the whole team in itself, and obviously it was open to a global audience the first time it was saw on TV. The whole world was watching it. I mean, it's so iconic. So, yeah, I think we have to agree that, for me, I think that 70 World Cup and the final in itself probably was his, in my opinion, his most iconic moment in the career of Pelé. So, Tim, going into what Pelé has achieved, you know, after the 1,000 goals, after the careers in Santos and even in the Cosmos, the careers, the three World Cups for Brazil, his reputation outside of a football pitch has really changed a lot. I mean, you know, he's been linked romantically with numerous people. He's had multiple wives, multiple children. He's very also outspoken politically. He's also had a lot of health issues as well. And, you know, with Pelé approaching the age of 80 come October, what has been the life of Pelé ever since he's hung up his boots in 77? And what do you think has changed?
Well, in a sense, I don't think he's ever hung up his boots, because his job has been preserving his place in the pantheon. I remember going into the 2006 World Cup. It was common, and in fact, this was on the front page of a big Brazilian magazine, the idea that this is the tournament, 2006, Germany 2006, is the tournament where Ronaldinho is going to prove that he's better than Pelé. Well, no one liked that less than Pelé. So Brazil's first game is against Croatia. And Ronaldinho plays badly, and at the end, he can hardly wait. Pelé can hardly wait to get over to the Brazilian press to say that he thought that Ronaldinho was the worst player on the field. So, you know, that jealous defense of his position has been one of the tasks. And one of the things that you've mentioned, that it's an aspect of his career that I don't particularly like, is like the concentration on the 1,000 goals or whatever. I mean, the numbers are just filled with, you know, goals for the Brazilian army and friendlies and so on. And it's not a measure of his greatness. So, you know, when he'll say to Messi, you know, come back when you scored 1,000 goals. You know, I think it's a ludicrous position because, you know, real competitive goals, Pelé doesn't have anything like 1,000. I think it's a wrong battleground. You know, the fact that he didn't score so many meaningful goals doesn't take anything away from his extraordinary greatness as a player. You say politically outspoken. I would say more knowing which side his bread is buttered, perhaps. And from a distance, at a time in Brazilian society, a time which unfortunately is has passed, the military dictatorship of 64 to the mid-80s was seen as a bad thing. When it was seen as a bad thing, Pelé said, I didn't play the 1974 World Cup as a protest against military, because I was making my own protest against Brazil's military dictatorship. No, I don't know anyone who believes that. You know, if that was his protest, he kind of kept it to himself. You know, Zagallo, who was the coach in 70 and in 74, said, you know, he told me that I would have loved to have picked Pelé. I really wanted to pick Pelé. I tried to pick Pelé, but, you know, he'd given priority to the financial side of things. And he'd signed a contract with Pepsi Cola, and, you know, he wanted to make money. Tostão, who was his teammate in 70, said it's more about going out at the top and preserve, you know, and leaving the best impression possible. So that this line about, you know, I was protesting about Brazil's military dictatorship, I don't think that shows Pelé off at his best. I also think there are aspects of, well, it's hard, I think, to remain 100% sane when you're surrounded by people telling you what a god you are. It's difficult. When his film came out, I've got this interview that he did when with the Jornal do Brasil, when he's put in the pantheon of 60s celebrities, you know, Muhammad Ali, the Beatles, so on. He adds one or two more to this list, and he says, talking about himself in the third person, as he so often does, he said, Pelé, I'll tell you this, Pelé was better than all of them. And which is, it's a strange thing to say. And then it gets even more insane because he said, well, you know, Martin Luther King, well, he got involved in politics, whereas the message of Pelé is one of sport. And I think, you know, I thought that was a terrible, terrible thing to say, an appalling thing to say, quite frankly. Because, you know, Martin Luther King was someone who consciously gave his life for the advancement of his people. Whereas Pelé, when it suited him, has tried to gain credit from taking a political stance that I don't think he really took. So that I kind of feel sorry for him in a way, because I think it's lonely at the top. And I think you do lack people around you to say, you know, you're wrong there. You know, come back down to earth. You're making a mistake there. You mentioned his wives and his women. I think he's quite entitled to as much of that as he wants. Although there was one daughter that he had out of wedlock who he didn't treat very well because she went public. And this kind of this damaged the image of Pelé, and she became a politician. She died young, unfortunately, but she became a politician in Santos, campaigning on the rights of children whose fathers won't recognize them. It became her issue. That's not good. You know, if you bring someone into the world, then he didn't live up to his responsibilities particularly well on that occasion. So he's a flawed human being, aren't we all? But I think some of that, in a way, that's the price that we had to pay for the can you have the literature of Dylan Thomas without the alcohol? You know, these people who without wanting to justify some of the, and he's not a master criminal or anything like that. You know, there are just one or two things that he perhaps should have done differently, but without that drive and the excesses of that drive, we wouldn't have had him as a footballer.
Quick short story before I get to my final segment, Tim and Rob. We had the company that I work for, we had our national sales meeting just at the beginning of February. And on the ride to the airport back from the meeting, I sat with a friend of mine who is Brazilian and in a former life or career was a limo driver. And His boss previously knew that he was Brazilian and said, here, I need you to go pick up somebody at the airport. He was working in New York. Said, I need you to go pick up somebody at the airport. He's probably a buddy of yours. And he said, a buddy of yours? He goes, who is it? He goes, Edson Arantes de Nascimento. And he goes, you mean Pele? Yeah, he was picking up Pele at the airport. At the time, Pele had a residence. I think he had an apartment in Manhattan. And that's probably as close as I'll ever get to Pele. But to have a legend like that and being a Brazilian is just something incredible. Mm-hmm. One question I want to ask you before I ask you my final question, Tim, is we've made the comparison of Pele to multiple players, both on the pitch, off the pitch. There was one thing that I saw in his documentary that intrigued me, and it was back in the late 50s when he was being brought into Santos, when he was being called up for the World Cup team, that there was a perception about him because he was a black athlete, that he was actually kind of breaking a barrier, especially at such a young age. Would you, Tim, compare what he did for football in Brazil for you know, children of color, because he's still a child at that point, 16 years old, would you compare him to what Jackie Robinson did here in the United States in baseball?
No, because it wasn't a novelty to have a black Brazilian star. I mean, that thing, it's really the 30s when that wall is breached. Brazil play a game in Montevideo against it's a friendly against Uruguay, who are the world champions. This is December of 32, and the two best players on the Brazil side are two young black Brazilians, Domingos da Guia, the centre back, and Leonidas da Silva up front. And Brazil hadn't gone professional at that time. Uruguay just has. And the big two Uruguayan clubs, Nacional and Peñarol, they see these two players and I think we're having some of that. So, you know, one gets signed to one club, one gets signed to the other. And that external shock forces, it's a vital moment in Brazil, which is very resistant to the idea of professionalism, in Brazil becoming professional, adopting professional football. Without professional football, there is no Pelé. Mm-hmm. So, because of the, you know, of the financial rewards, it becomes a career then that's open to talent. And if you look at say the 1950 side, you know, Leonidas and Domingos were the two best players of the team that came third in the 38 World Cup. 1950, you've got the magnificent Zizinho. If I had a time machine and the ability to go back and see one player, it would probably be Zizinho, who I think was an extraordinary player. But now that black Brazilian, Pelé's idol, the idol of the young Pelé. So there were others who'd come before him, who'd opened the door for him as a black player, to the extent that it wasn't at all a novelty. So I don't think you can compare him at all to Jackie Robinson. And also, I think he loses points on this one with the great Muhammad Ali, who some of the kind of politicized black Brazilians have always been a bit angry with Pelé, because I don't think he's done enough for the cause.
Wow. I want to ask you another question. Who is the greatest player you've ever seen play?
Well, I'm just too young for Pelé. Mm-hmm. So that excludes him. Maradona, I've never seen anyone do what Maradona did in the 86 World Cup, in the decisive games in the 86 World Cup, including the final, the pass that he plays to Buruşaga for the goal. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anyone hit that level. And that was extraordinary what he did, quarter final, semi final, and final. But for longevity, for consistency, because the career of Maradona just weaves all over the place, doesn't it?
It does.
It was a long career, but, you know, it just weaves all over the place. For consistent longevity and for, you know, I remember watching him in what's become not a great Barcelona side over recent years. And I remember watching him and thinking, you give him a brick, you know, which is a kind of almost like a slang Brazilian word for a bad pass. You give him a brick and he builds a house. Lionel Messi. And part of that is because These things are subjective. I just happened to see him right at the start, South American Under-20 Championships in 2005, when no one had even heard of him. He played one friendly for Barcelona. So I followed that all the way through. I wish sometimes he had some of the fire of Pelé or Maradona. You can clearly see in this, getting towards, sadly, the last few years of Messi's career, you can see him really straining to become more of a leader. We saw this in the Copa America with Argentina. We're seeing at Barcelona now. But just the way that Messi is not only playing the game, but seemingly watching it from the best seat in the house as well. So for pure consistency, year after year after year, it would have to be Messi. Although, you know, that the heights of Maradona in those three games in the World Cup, I've never seen anyone reach.
Now, Rob, I want to ask you a similar question, but before I do that, I'm going to put my two cents in. You know, I've always said all along that for me, Pelé is the greatest player ever. I know we have these conversations, the Messi Ronaldo question, and all that good stuff. And I've seen enough video of everyone, including Maradona. You know, Maradona is somebody that I can certainly remember the hand of God and all of those things. But Pele, you know, Tim, I'm only slightly younger than you. And so my first World Cup was really 78, not 74. And so for everything I've seen of Pele is really more video. In doing my research for this particular podcast, the stuff that I saw Pele do with his feet, the stuff that I saw him do with his brain. You talked about the Uruguayan goalkeeper in that play. You talk about the Carlos Alberto pass. You talk about, you know, the goals that he's scored and the emotion and the skill and the speed and the strength. And I've got to say, I have never seen anyone stand out over their peers like I saw Pele in those videos stand out over his peers and the players that he played with. Maradona stood out. We've seen Messi stand out. We've seen Cristiano Ronaldo stand out. But I've never seen anyone ever stand out like a sore thumb like the way Pele did against those players. Rob, I want to go to you. And I know we've asked, and it's tough to compare over eras, you know, comparing Messi to Pele. I know we always have trouble with that. We don't want to pick a best player, but I'd like your thoughts on Pele and where he stands overall in the pantheon of world football.
Well, I know that I'm too young for both Pele and Maradona, that I've never seen them. It's funny, actually, I do have a story. My dad saw Maradona. He saw it in the 94 World Cup in his last Argentina goal against Greece, the 4-0 victory. So obviously, and my dad has told me about that and told me even about Pele, even the little glimpse of what he achieved in the sport, even if he was around the same age as you guys. For me, I mean, obviously, seeing the sport as itself and recognizing the history of what it is, you know, it's kind of like, you don't want to make a big comparison, but it's kind of like a politician as well. Like, oh, who's the best president ever? Who's the best baseball player ever? Who's the best basketball player ever? You know, I never saw Jordan, but I would say if I had to pick one, maybe Kobe Bryant or LeBron James. Or if it's tennis, you know, I didn't see the likes of Bjorn Borg or Pete Sampras, but I saw Federer and Nadal. I mean, for football, it's different. You know, I've seen Messi, I've seen Cristiano Ronaldo. But I have to recognize that with Pele and the way that he was able to demonstrate just how important he is for the sport forever and how he's always going to be recognized as that kind of name. You think of the sport, you think of one name, and yeah, people will say Messi or Ronaldo or Maradona, but Pele is the one. He's the one. It's like Ali for boxing. It's like Babe Ruth for baseball, Michael Jordan for basketball. He's that connected. So I have to, while I do agree with Tim, of course, saying that, you know, in sheer terms of consistency for a decade and a half, and of course, I've seen it since the beginning to the end, unfortunately, about to be the end, I would say Messi's the greatest player that I've ever seen kick a football. But I have to recognize that for Pele and what he was able to achieve during his career, what he's done at Santos for Brazil winning those three World Cups, and what he's done to change the sport and to make it more probably globalized and more recognized around the world, I have to tip my hat onto that.
Just great stuff. Gentlemen, it was an absolute honor and a pleasure to be with both of you tonight to discuss the great Pele. So for Tim Vickery and for Roberto Rojas, this was our Hall of Foot featuring Pele for This Week in Football from the makers of Low Limit Football. I'm your host, Joe Usello. Thanks again for listening, and good night.